Before we kick off the show, if you're a fan of History Hack, please do what you can to support the show. We completely get that not everyone is able or willing to dig into their pockets. Times are hard, but by dropping a like, subscribing on Twitter and YouTube, and importantly, leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts, you can help the program grow and reach more people. If you're interested in becoming a supporter, go to patreon.com/historyhack, where you'll find perks from secret Facebook groups to early release material. If you just want to leave us a one-off tip, go to ko-fi.com/historyhack. The links are in the description. And whatever form your kind support takes, know that we are massively grateful. Enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to another edition of History Hack. Lockie here, and I have immense imposter syndrome because although we are talking about something that I should have some knowledge about, I do not have any at all. We're in Suffolk. We're close to a brewery that I really, really love, and I know nothing, and I'm here to learn, and helping me is the very lovely and beautiful Charlie. Hello, Charlie. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you for that very kind introduction. That's above and beyond.
Well, yeah, you're here to teach me. We're in your period, at least, wheelhouse. Yes. In my geographical area, but as far as period goes, it's you. This is all you.
Yeah, this is where I like to hang out. We are in my comfort zone of the 17th century, and we actually have an anniversary coming up. So this is like really very, very pertinent stuff that everyone should know, but nobody knows because we don't mention the Anglo-Dutch Wars. We don't like to mention them because, hint, we don't really win them. So this is proper 17th century stuff. And we are joined by a fabulous guest today. We are joined by Maya Wassell Smith. She is a researcher at the Queen's House, which is arguably the most glamorous part of the Royal Museums in Greenwich. And she's the principal researcher for the Solebay Tapestry Project. And she's going to be telling us all about the legacy of the Battle of Solebay in art and how this is being preserved for future generations. Hello, Maya.
Hi, lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's wonderful to have you on. I'm so excited to talk about the tapestry and the campaign that you've been running to restore it. Because when we say we're talking about a tapestry, we're not talking about a little piece of embroidery that somebody's done. This is a big, big thing, right?
Yeah, I think it's around 5 meters by 4 meters. So yeah, a real whopper.
Oh my goodness. So just for Lockie and for our listeners, I'm just going to give you a brief intro into the Battle of Solebay and what we're actually talking about. So the Battle of Solebay was fought in 1672. So we're coming up to the 400, is it 400 years? This is where I have a moment with my maths.
350th, is it?
Is it? 350th, yeah. Not 400. But
2022 we're in. That
That's one. It. What year are we in?
Not where you live your life. But yeah.
No, exactly. So, you know, we're not in the 17th century. So yeah, 350 years since the Battle of Solebay. And it was fought between the English and the Dutch, but we also had a bit of a silent partner, not so silent partner in the French. So it's the English and French versus the Dutch. And at this point, why are we fighting the Dutch? We're fighting the Dutch because we need to destroy their navy. There's battles going on. Someone is going to be in charge of trade. And we want that to be us. Whoever controls the trade routes gets the money. Whoever's got the money builds the bigger navy. And if we are a very small island here, if we don't have a powerful navy, then we are in big trouble. Same for the Dutch. If they don't have a lot of money and a powerful navy, they are at risk from being attacked on the land from the French. The Spanish already have what's known as the Spanish Netherlands. So both of these countries, having boats and having money is very important. This is why we fight the Dutch, even though it seems that they would perhaps be natural allies for us. So this is real, real potted, terrible, terrible skimming over of the history. But we wanted to talk about the tapestry itself today because it was commissioned at the time of the battle. That's what's really interesting about it. So Maya, what is the Solebay tapestry? And what was the purpose of it?
So the tapestry series was commissioned in sometime around 1674, we think. So 2 years after the battle, during a period of relative peace with the Dutch. So, you know, the Third Anglo War has finished and, you know, we're on relatively good terms. It was commissioned by Charles II, James Duke of York, later James II. And they commissioned the Van der Velders, their father and son, marine artists based at the Queen's house, to draw up the designs for the tapestries. And then separately, they commissioned Francis Poyntz, who was the King's chief arras worker, to kind of oversee the weaving of the tapestry series. The commission was originally for 10 tapestries, 5 to depict the Battle of Lowestoft in 1665, and 5 to depict the Battle of Salt Bay. In the end, only 6 were made, and they all show Salt Bay. We're not quite sure why that happened, but potentially there were some financial implications. And those 6 tapestries are now shared between several museums, of which Royal Museums Greenwich is one. And our tapestry shows really the defining loss of the battle, which is the burning of the Royal James, the flagship of Edward Montagu, 1st Earl of Sandwich. And it shows, you know, the fire in which he and the majority of his crew died. In terms of purpose, tapestries in the 17th century, and indeed the centuries before, were kind of multifunctional. So, you know, obviously they were very beautiful pieces of fantastically expensive luxury art, but also they served a practical function, you know, hanging thick textile on the walls of your palace or castle is a good way to keep out drafts, retain warmth, you know, absorb sound, all of those things. There's also a communicative element. So, you know, you might even say propaganda in what people are choosing to weave into tapestry, but also, you know, the occasions and the locations in which they're displayed.
It all sounds massive, and I'm kind of immediately getting visions of things that I see at the British Museum when I take people around there, like the kind of Assyrian artwork that you would have expected to walk into a palace to see, one of the kings slaying lions or something like that. I mean, my knowledge of Solbay basically consists of hanging around Southwold and drinking nice beer and seeing the kind of guns overlooking the seafront. Although they're mostly overlooking some extremely expensive beach huts. And my understanding of the battle was that it's not a victory, is it? For our brave boys. And I've got a number of questions, really. I mean, firstly, getting the French on the same side as us seems deeply counterintuitive, first of all. But before I do any of that, if it's not a victory, why do we have this thing? Why did, you know, Charles, what does he want the battle to be remembered as?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of the elements that Charles and James are really trying to get across in the tapestries is, you know, the real drama and danger of sea fighting. You know, ships are shown with their sails tattered by gunshot. The sea is filled with debris. You know, we can see 4 vessels on fire. You know, 3 of those are the fire ships that are launched at the Royal James, but also, you know, the Royal James itself is engulfed in flames. There is, you know, smoke pouring across the battlefield. You know, you can even see the crew, the men, kind of jumping from the ship into the sea. So yeah, there is a real sense that they are trying to communicate the kind of spectacle of battle. But I think it's also interesting and important to think about the tapestries in relation to another series of tapestries, which depicted the Spanish Armada. And they're really the only other naval tapestry series in this period, and they occupied a really prominent position. in both political and diplomatic life. So they are made at the end of the 16th century, and by the middle of the 17th century, they are displayed in the House of Lords, and they go on to stay there for several hundred years. And so perhaps there's a sense that by copying, in some ways, the Armada tapestries, that Charles and James are trying to kind of rewrite Solebay as their own Armada and kind of elevate their marine exploits, to the level of those kind of previous legendary victories.
I think that's a wonderful suggestion to make, harking back to the Armada and Britain as this sort of all-encompassing naval power. You're victorious on the seas. One of the reasons that we gave for having to attack the Dutch was because they refused to salute English ships as they passed. Now, this is this sort of crazy little bit of sovereignty that we had at this time, was that England or Britain owned the seas. That was our territory. So any passing ships should dip their flags in respect. And so the pride and bringing that across in the tapestries. But I also think the timing is really interesting here, because you say they were commissioned in 1674.
That's right.
So all this time you've got a big problem for Charles with, he doesn't have a legitimate heir. He doesn't have a son by his wife. He's plenty of other sons, but he doesn't have a legitimate heir, and his heir is his brother James, Duke of York, who is not a popular man because it's kind of looking like he might be a little bit Catholic, which is a worry for Parliament and a worry for a lot of people. So playing him up as a naval hero is a big thing, and I wonder if showing the demise of the Earl of Sandwich, who had been a really very much loved naval hero, if that might have been a little bit of a repositioning of James and Charles as the big naval men, and now that Sandwich is gone.
Yeah, that's a really interesting thought. As I understand it, James is Lord High Admiral and Earl of Sandwich's Vice Admiral had quite a complicated relationship, like often quite fractious. There's some stories, I'm not 100% on the veracity of them, that, Sandwich was challenging James on the eve of the Battle of Solebay, kind of saying, you're not preparing in the right way, you're not kind of planning in the right way. But despite those kind of disagreements, the way that James and Charles, discuss or depict the Earl of Sandwich publicly is, one of celebration. So I'm thinking about things like the portrait series, The Flagman of Lowestoft, which is commissioned by James and depicts all the captains who served under him at the Battle of Lowestoft. And Sandwich is one of those, depicted in a very grand way. But also the Earl of Sandwich's funeral after this kind of heroic death at Solebay is largely paid for by Charles. It's a complex one. But I wonder whether, rather than kind of wrestling naval esteem from the Earl of Sandwich, the commission is potentially more personal for James. So, given that Solebay and Lowestoft are the only battles that James attended and commanded in person, it's more about celebrating the Duke of York's own naval success, even if perhaps they weren't necessarily that successful. But thinking more generally, I think we can certainly say that maritime art and marine art, including the tapestries, is intentionally used by Charles and James to draw attention to, potentially even exaggerate, their role in making Britain a global maritime power, particularly in the face of kind of rumours of Catholicism and accusations of popery. And it's the way that they fashion themselves into sovereigns of the seas, you know, advertising their naval prowess, but legitimating their kind of role as rulers, really. And they did that in several ways. So, you know, the Van der Velders are a great example of the sorts of artists that they were paying, you know, pretty generous salaries to paint the British fleet and British naval battles. They also, you know, invested in the architecture of Greenwich in order to create these kind of court spaces which overlooked naval activities on the Thames. They had medals struck, which kind of broadcast their naval victories. They had paintings commissioned, which depicted them kind of almost as sea gods. So, you know, they're certainly using maritime art in that way to kind of rewrite the narrative on themselves.
It does seem, especially because they'd had a tough few years since the Restoration, hadn't they? I mean, I don't know how superstitious people were, but when you go from war through plague through great fire, you know, you're going to try and focus on the positives a bit, aren't you? It just seemed a little counterintuitive that you don't go for a victory. Did they have any great victories to trumpet then, or is this as good as they had?
I mean, as far as I understand, I think Lowestoft is the best that they have. And then, yeah, Solebay is kind of the next best, but was a bit of a so-so.
They were evenly matched. I think this was the problem, is that, you know, we were very much leading the world. I say we, obviously being very Anglo-centric. Sorry, I can't help it. England was leading the world in terms of shipbuilding. We've been doing it for years. We were really, really good at it. But the Dutch were awesome. They were really, really clever. They were really organized. Their method of signaling was ahead of us, and we had to kind of figure that out during the earlier Dutch wars. So by this time, this is the third Anglo-Dutch war. The first one was fought under the Protectorate. So Sandwich had been out there as Edward Montagu way earlier. The second is when we have Lowestoft. And James is actually sent home after Lowestoft. He's grounded by his brother because three guys standing next to him all take the same cannonball. And James gets splattered in blood. And this is the only air you've got at this moment. So James gets grounded. I think it's interesting that he managed to wangle his way out for Solebay, but they all thought it was going to be a really easy victory. No one was expecting a fight. They thought they'd got them. They thought we got the Dutch unawares, but they knew exactly what we were up to. But let's bring this back to the tapestry. Let's bring it back to what we were discussing, Maya. Who were the Van der Velders? Because they've got a brilliant name. It just feels so good to say.
Yeah, not just a good name, but they share the name, which is sometimes quite difficult when you're talking about them publicly. So they were Dutch artists, both, you know, celebrated for their ability to depict marine scenes. The elder, Willem van der Velde, the elder was almost kind of a proto-photojournalist. So what he did was go out with the Dutch fleet in his little boat, you know, position somewhere behind the Dutch line and take sketches, you know, at the scene, just fastidiously making record. And then he would go home and draw these up, you know, in many different ways, and created this technique, this medium called the pen wash, which he was very much celebrated for. His son, Willem van der Velde the younger, worked much more with colour, and it's kind of the painting side of the duo. So they are already pretty well celebrated in the Netherlands. But Charles II offers them, he offers his several artists, or, you know, he kind of puts out a call to artists, but they come over to be kind of employed or given a salary by Charles to draw up their own sketches. So as I say, they took sketches at the scene, and they had this kind of fantastic archive, largely of battles from the Anglo-Dutch Wars, but also kind of some other European conflicts. So they had this fantastically rich archive of what happened, you know, on the day right there. So he pays them to kind of draw those up into both pen and wash pictures, but also in paintings. And you know they create almost a factory, if you like. They are really churning this stuff out, and they're in the Queen's house. They have studios at the front of the house, so the side that kind of looks over the top half of Greenwich Park, and then when they get the commission for the tapestries, we have a kind of tantalizing record which says that they use rooms in the upper part of the house, in the upper floors, to kind of lay out what we call cartoons, so the kind of large scale drawings or paintings made by the artists, which the tapestry weavers can then copy to kind of get the things. So they're really fascinating figures, and also the subjects of an exhibition at Royal Museums Greenwich next year, opening in February, which is the 350th anniversary of when they came and started working in the Queen's house.
That's just fantastic. I got to see some of these pen drawings at the Queen's house this week, and what struck me about them was how detailed they are. It's not like, you know, if I was in a boat surrounded by a battle trying to draw it with a pen. You know, these are so meticulously detailed, and you can see the men on the ships and then, you know, in the water, and it's incredible how they've done that under what must have been, you know, quite a lot of pressure.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that the sketch record shows, you know, we have a significant collection of Van der Velde sketches. The exact number escapes me, but it's in the kind of definitely in the thousands. And one of the things that you get from them is that the sketches are reworked, so that he is taking detail at the scene. But then once he's back in the studio, he's reworking them with additional detail. He trained as a draftsman, so I think there's also the possibility that he is taking detail from ships when they're in port and then adding that. Because, I mean, you know, the ships at this time have such incredible detail on the stern, you know, these fantastic carvings, these elaborate paintings. And, you know, gold everywhere. He's taking that detail and adding it in afterwards and kind of continually working these drawings up.
It seems to be quite a fraternal sort of conflict, you know, the fact that, you know, you've got the English and Dutch, you're supposed to be brothers in Protestantism, aren't they? And the fact that Charles, he spent time in the Netherlands, did he, when he was in exile? Is that where he gets the idea from to bring Dutch artists over? Because there seems to be something quite odd about Dutch people working on art in the Anglo-Dutch Wars in England.
Yeah, it's odd. As you say, that kind of brothers fighting is an interesting metaphor, because there's so many cultural links between the Netherlands and England at the time, you know, further into Britain. And yet, yeah, we're at war. They're certainly not the first Dutch artists to come and work in the UK. There's, you know, I'm thinking about people like the portrait artist Peter Lely. You know, there's fantastically Dutch are very well known for producing kind of great artists at the time. So I think Charles is seeking to develop England's reputation in that respect, and you know, borrowing some Dutch artists is a good way to do that.
Fantastic. I mean, you talk about brothers at war and familial relationships. It's such a mess at this point in in time, because you've got William in Holland, who is Charles's nephew, because Charles and James's sister Mary married his another William and had a son who would go on to become our William III. So he's in Holland at this time. You've also got in France Louis XIV, who is Charles and James's cousin, because their mother is his aunt, and their younger sister Henriette Anne Minette is married to the Duke of Orléans. So she is, other than the Queen, like the First Lady of France. This is hugely problematic, and in terms of relationships, which is why at this time we are allied with the French, because this is all part of a huge treaty that happened in 1670, which we've spoken about on here before, because I think it's one of the biggest cons ever done. We are in an alliance with France to give them military aid in their battle against the Dutch, because they want some more land. And as part of that treaty, Charles has agreed to convert to Catholicism in exchange for a French army if he needs it. And that won't be found out for another 100 odd years. So it's incredibly tangled, this net. And it's going to get even more so, because very shortly after this, we are going to marry off James's daughter, Mary.
Wondering, has that happened yet? Not yet. No.
Don't think it's happened quite yet. I think this is part of the peace treaty afterwards, but I might be wrong. But yeah, it's very, very complex. But this is an exciting time right now. We're talking about this tapestry, Maya. When was the last time we were able to see it? I mean, it's had to go through some restoration, or it's being restored. Where is it at the moment?
Yeah, so the tapestry hasn't been on display for 22 years, even though it's been in the collection since the 60s. So the reason that it hasn't been on display for such a long time is that, you know, several centuries of hanging and light exposure had significantly weakened and damaged it. So at the moment we have this kind of team of incredibly skilled textile conservators strengthening the tapestry, restoring some of the detail in the image in order for it to go on display next year, as I say, potentially in one of the rooms that it was originally conceived in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that work, which is taking about a year, is significantly expensive, as you might imagine. So over the last few months, we have been we've been running a campaign alongside the Art Fund to ask the public for a contribution towards the work of restoring the Solbay tapestry. The campaign ended last 2 weeks ago, I think. And, you know, the generosity has really surpassed our expectations. So
how much were you trying to raise?
Sorry?
How much are you trying to raise?
So we initially set the target at £15,000, which, as I say, is a contribution of the total cost. But, you know, we raised that money, that money was pledged by the end of the first day. So, you know, we were really excited. And, you know, over the course of the campaign, it went on to almost double. So, yeah, we're incredibly grateful, but also really excited to have the tapestry safely, you know, back on display, hopefully for many decades to come.
Gosh, what needed to happen to it? I mean, is, you know, in terms of, I know nothing about the physicality of a tapestry. Does it just need cleaning, or does it need restitching, or can you restitch it?
I mean, it's a bit of everything, to be honest. So yeah, the first thing that happened to it was that it was washed. Well, I think it had a backing on it that had been put on you know, sometime in the centuries between its production and now. So first of all, it's kind of undoing some of the restoration work that has, you know, been done in the previous centuries with the best intentions, but certainly not with the kind of techniques and materials that we might use today. Then it underwent this amazing washing process. So it was packed up and sent off to Belgium, I think, where it was laid out in this special tapestry bath, and the kind of the water was like sucked through it. I don't quite understand the technique, but it is, you know, absolutely state of the art. Then came back to the conservation studio in Brighton, and then they have started the kind of really laborious and time intensive process of going through the tapestry section by section, strengthening the warps, which go up and down, so that they kind of hold the structure of the tapestry together, but also where detail has been lost either by damage, so, you know, moths and tapestries are not good friends, or by light is a really significant factor in damaging the tapestries. I mean, the Solbay tapestry is a particularly vulnerable tapestry because it has so much silk in.
Right.
Often tapestries are a mixture of wool and silk in the weft, so that the coloured wool and silk that makes the picture. But because of the kind of expanses of blue and the subtle shades in the sea and the sky, there's lots of silk use, which would have produced this amazing luster when it was first made, but sadly has made it vulnerable. So yeah, it's a really time intensive and labor intensive process. And then at the end of that, they will reback it and kind of support it and strengthen it with an additional linen backing, and then hang it. So yeah, it's an exciting time.
It sounds incredibly complex. I wasn't expecting you to take it down to the laundrette in Lewisham or anything like that. But
get the rug doctor out.
Yeah, I don't know what the difference between a weft and a warp.
So as far as I always forget it myself, but I'm pretty sure that warp goes up and down and the weft goes from weft to right or left to right.
That'd be a way to remember it.
Yeah.
So in terms of the actual exhibition itself, we're looking at February. What can we expect to see when we get our tickets and come down to the Queen's House? What are we going to see in the exhibition?
So the exhibition is really positioning the Van der Velders as agents in the birth of marine art in Britain. So looking at their networks of patrons that they are selling to, looking at how they are working within a studio. So some of the other works that have been conserved is Willem van der Velde the Younger's Royal Visit to the Fleet, which is, you know, an enormous and amazing, beautiful painting, which our painting conservators have been working tirelessly on. So I think one of the things that we are trying to get across is the working process of this father and son team, you know, how they're moving from battle sketch to painting, as I say, who they're selling to. There's lots of interesting research to be kind of broadcast and shared with the public.
Has your research kicked up any more that's kind of tied into this that people might be interested in?
I hope they will be interested in lots of the elements of my research. One of the strands which I'm following up at the moment is the movement of the tapestries kind of after they are completed, but also after James Duke of York is, or James II is dethroned in 1688, obviously. So we know that three of the six tapestries remain in the royal collection, where they remain today. Go and see them in Hampton Court Palace. But three leave the royal collection sometime before 1695. So I'm kind of trying to follow that up. The three that did leave resurface in the early 20th century. And by that point, they'd had a coat of arms woven into them of the Walpole family. But it's never been quite clear which member of the Walpole family acquired the tapestries, when that occurred, but also what sort of transaction was it? Were they purchasing directly from the Great Wardrobe, or was it a gift? You know, those sorts of questions. It does look like the person who acquired them was Horatio Walpole, who was ambassador and diplomat in the early 18th century, and also brother of the more famous Robert Walpole, Britain's first prime minister. And one lead that I'm following up at the moment concerns Horace Walpole, who I'm sure you and your listeners are well acquainted with, kind of 18th century aesthete, novelist, creator of Strawberry Hill, self-proclaimed expert on art and antiques. And it does look like he once owned the tapestries, partly through inheritance. So he inherits the house that they are hung in. But as an absentee landlord, he doesn't know that he owns them. And in his books, he writes about the Van der Velders. He writes about the Armada tapestries. He also writes about a series of tapestries at Blenheim, which are kind of a series of military tapestries. But while he's writing about them, he doesn't know that he kind of owns half of the series, which connect all of those things and, you know, potentially rival them.
Oh, my goodness. How can you not know that you own these? They're not small, as we've mentioned. You can't place them.
Well, I'm just wondering how common things like this were. I mean, I guess maybe a little bit, but not on this scale, maybe.
I mean, I think certainly if you had a stately home or a number of stately homes, then you've likely got a collection of tapestries. But they're certainly still pretty rare. I mean, they're also just fantastically valuable. So. Yeah, it's a real shock that he. I mean, I don't want to say definitely yet, but it looks like he didn't know they were there.
Oh. Am I allowed to make the joke about him not knowing his arse from his elbow?
Of course you are.
We'd be disappointed if you didn't.
Yeah, no, I know. Sorry, everyone. Okay, I'm gonna just drag us back to the history just for a moment I'm curious as to what happened after the Battle of Sol Bay. And I know Charlie's hinted that there's a story in this. So I'm Charlie, please tell us.
One of my favourite stories. So again, forgive me for paraphrasing this and skimming over a lot of detail. But basically what happens is Sol Bay is a bit of a draw. Everybody says that they won. We say we won. The Dutch say they won. Fine. It looked like the English got a bit of an advantage with the wind. So the wind changed and it pushed the Dutch back into their ports. So it looked like they retreated. So we went home claiming that we'd won. And they probably thought that we also retreated. But afterwards, what starts to happen in the years that follow, this is it's not a massively long conflict, but we send over some ambassadors to go and talk to William of Orange. Now, William of Orange is not the guy in charge at this point. When he's born, his father leaves a little bit of a mess in terms of his admin, and William's not immediately declared stadtholder, which is boss guy. That instead goes to a guy called the grand pensionary, Johan de Witt, and de Witt kind of runs the Netherlands at this time. His brother is also very involved, Cornelius. But like we said, there's a familial thing here. This is Charles II's nephew, and he writes to him and says, look, William, let's stop this fighting. We'll stop this fighting now. I'm going to make you stadtholder. I'm going to back you all the way. We could end the fighting tomorrow and no one needs to die, if only it wasn't for your terrible, terrible politicians, the De Witts. What William does is he publishes this letter. He publishes the letter and he shows it round. And the Dutch people rise up, they kill the De Witts and they eat them.
Oh my gosh.
We don't know conclusively that they were eaten. We know that they were lynched. genuinely happened. So apparently William said that he told the ambassadors who said, you know, this could be over tomorrow, just say the word and we'll end it. He said the war is not over until the last Dutchman has died in the last ditch. He wasn't going to give up for anything. But the fact that he published this letter just makes me think that William was, he had a little bit of something about him. He had a bit of that Stuart blood, a bit of that double dealing. But yes, the De Witts were lynched and possibly eaten by the people.
I mean, were the people hungry or was it just...
How hungry have you got to be?
After the course, I mean...
But this is
tasty looking.
This is why I don't understand why people aren't more interested in the Anglo-Dutch wars, because I know it's not, we don't have the kind of glory of other naval engagements that we got into, but my goodness, the drama.
Drama. Yeah, I mean, I'm afraid to ask if you've got any more stories.
No, shocked him. Thankfully, right. I don't have any pencil drawings of that.
No. Or tapestries, for that matter. Right, so if I were going to come and visit this absolutely fabulous tapestry, what would I do? I'd get off the train at Greenwich.
Yes, very definitely.
Get the DLR.
Yeah, you have to wait a few months. It's right. It's not quite ready yet, not quite baked. Okay. But yeah, it's due to open in February 2033. In the Queen's House, so on site. More details forthcoming, but yeah, come along to Greenwich.
Fantastic. And in the meantime, just go to Greenwich anyway and go to the Maritime Museum, because it's absolutely fantastic. And take the 2-minute walk and go to the Queen's House, because like I say, I was there the other day and I was pretty much the only person in there having a lovely time. And it does have those flagmen portraits that you mentioned, Maya. What's your favourite thing at the museum? Is there something that you really love that you don't think people give enough attention to?
Oh, well, so my other research kind of role is looking at something completely different to the Solebay tapestries. I'm also a researcher of sailor art and sailor craft in the 19th century. So in the Queen's House, we also have some woolwork embroideries made by sailors. I'd have to say that they are my favourite, but who knows, when the tapestry goes on display, maybe they'll be, you know, from the very small to the very big, but yeah, maybe they'll be challenged.
Amazing. Well, Maya, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been really, really wonderful to hear about your work and to hear about the tapestry. Lockie, thank you so much for letting me be nerdy about 17th century stuff.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Amazing. Thanks so much.